welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Lawrence Conley. Lawrence C. Conley's fiction has appeared in Rod Serling's Twilight Zone magazine, Year's Best Horror Stories, The Best of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, and numerous others. The 2002 edition of Houghton Mifflin's Best American Mystery Stories identified Conley's The Break-In Artist as one of the distinguished mysteries of 2001. He currently serves as a writer-in-residence at Seton Hill University and a full-time member of the English faculty at Sewickley Academy. His novel Veins, set in the coal fields of southwestern Pennsylvania, was released in August, and he will read from it tonight. Hi, Lawrence. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you, Ellen.
Thanks so much for coming to Prosody. How about we start out tonight with you reading a little bit?
Sounds great. This is a piece that comes near the beginning of the book, and it introduces a character of Axel and his great-grandmother. And it also gives us a nice look at the western Pennsylvania landscape. And since the story of Veins deals in part with some journeys, this is a journey that Axel takes with his grandmother, great-grandmother, into the highlands behind his home and into a place where the ground opens up into an abandoned surface mine. Great-grandmother had arms like ropes, sinewy, long, tied off at the ends with withered fists. She wore a sleeveless vest and denim jeans. Her hair was long, hanging in braids that she secured with clips of hand-tooled bone. Her braids swung as she walked, slapping her back with soft rhythms. The long walk into the highlands was her idea. He had agreed to go along because she had bribed him, promising to give him the money he needed to rent a run-down garage in Winslow Bottoms. And because he had nothing better to do, having been suspended from school for stealing the glow plugs from his history teacher's Volvo. He was a troubled kid, 18 and foundering in the deep end of adolescence. For some reason, great-grandmother thought that a walk into the highlands would straighten him out. He turned as he followed her, looking back along the cracked pavement of Cliff Mine Run, the poorly maintained strip of asphalt that wound into the hills to the north of downtown Winslow. He could still see his neighborhood, a sprawl of corrugated steel and mossy fences, the hard-scrabble trailer park that residents called Coles Hollow, a nowhere place on the edge of oblivion. Past the park's entrance, the asphalt eventually widened, becoming a proper street that extended toward a shopping district where plywood covered many of the storefronts, and the clock above the municipal building remained forever stuck at 4:30. Behind Coles Hollow, accessible by a dirt path, the bends of Winslow Road meandered toward the interstate. Both routes, south on Cliff Mine and north on Winslow, led toward freedom. If great-grandmother wouldn't give him the body shop money, Axel figured he'd soon take off along one of those roads, escape Coles Hollow, never return. She kept walking until she came to a point where Cliff Mine Run veered sharply to the right. He expected her to follow the asphalt, but instead she stepped onto the shoulder and toward a weedy slope that descended into a wall of trees. "What's this about, Yayastani?" he called her by the old name, the one she preferred to great-grandmother. "Where are you taking me?" "Winslow Mine." "But this isn't the way." He had been to the mine before, always entering along a dirt trail that abutted a lower extension of Winslow Road. "The mine's in the other direction." "The low part is, but we're not going there." She entered the trees, becoming a voice in the shadows. "We're going to the high wall." He stood on the side of the road. "Am I supposed to follow you?" No answer. He stepped forward, crossing the shoulder until he stood before a path that had not been visible before. Gouged by truck wheels, the path rose in the middle, rutted on the sides, covered with a blanket of knotted weeds. It was an old coal-hauling road, cut before he was born, probably abandoned since the death of his father. The ruts extended through an arch of trees that thinned on one side after a few dozen feet. He saw a stand of low weeds where the trees fell away. Beyond the weeds, a steep slope descended toward the sound of running water. A creek, he thought. The countryside was riddled with them, shallow rills meandering through the highlands, gradually wending their way toward Winslow Bottoms and out to the Monongahela River. Some of the creeks had names: Sawmill Creek, Bottoms Creek, Cliffmine Creek. But most were nameless ruts. There was no way to keep track of them all. The trail continued past the slope, running parallel to it for a short distance before curving into a wide, level clearing. He moved forward, down the trail, past the sound of running water, and onto the oval patch of cleared ground. The rutted trail extended beyond the curve, bisecting the clearing and passing beneath a chain that hung suspended between concrete posts. Riveted to a center link, a rusted sign claimed the site as property of OSM. The name meant nothing to him. Beyond the chain, the wheel ruts continued straight for another 100 feet before curving again, this time into total darkness. "Hey," he called. No answer. "This is stupid, Yayastani. I'm going home." Silence. Of course, she didn't need to answer. They both knew what was at stake. If he turned back, she'd keep her money and he'd never get his body shop. It wouldn't matter to her that his life had no other prospects and that not getting the body shop would keep him on the fast track to nowhere. She was belligerent that way. He stepped over the chain, following the trail, and soon came to a place where the forest thickened to his left, becoming a woven fortress of creepers and brambles. To his right, the rock wall curved inward, forming a shale alcove. Looking up, he saw that the alcove's wall extended straight for 30 feet or so, ending at an overhang ledge and a giant tree that tilted beyond the brink. A gibbous moon lay in the tree's branches, glowing through brittle leaves, mottling the forest floor with silver light. The old woman couldn't have scaled the cliff any more than she could have pushed her way into the bramble forest. She had to be somewhere on the level path. But where? "Yayastani!" The rock wall amplified his voice, and this time when the reverberations died, something stirred, the windless hiss of branches and leaves, spirit sounds, whispers of the earth-born guardian. He shivered and cupped his hands to his mouth, pushing his voice as loud as it would go. "Yayastani, where are you?" The hissing stopped. Silence returned. And then, within the silence, a voice from beyond the bend. "This way." It was Yayastani. "Come on." He did as she said, hurrying forward until the path straightened and the forest opened before the edge of a deep crater. She was there, waiting for him, standing at the mouth of a ledge road that led down along a face of sheared-off rock. He knew where he was now. Although he had never seen it from this angle, he recognized the terrain. Looking beyond Yegastani's shoulders, he saw trails running like screw threads toward the floor of a man-made valley. And way down on the valley floor, an unpaved road stretching south toward Winslow. He walked toward her. "Careful," she said, keeping her back to him, her face toward the wide crater of the abandoned Winslow surface mine. "This is the ground that swallowed your father."
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Lawrence C. Connolly, reading from his novel Veins. Lawrence, your work falls into the realm of fantasy, magical realism. I don't know if you have a preference in terms of terminology, and you might even explain if there is a difference there. And we're introduced to it very early in the book. In the prologue, there's a creature. I don't know if later in your reading we'll come upon him or not, but there's a creature who's not of this world that as we know it, who's introduced. And this kind of extraordinary other sense of life kind of builds momentum as the book progresses. One of the things I was thinking about as I was reading, because I'll be honest, I'm not as familiar with fantasy, is that in science fiction, it seems how they deal with it is in terms of gadgets and, you know, what are the devices that we'll use moving forward, those kind of thing. Fantasy, it seems more character-based to me. And I was just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes, I'd like to. I do think that fantasy tends to be more character-based, although there's a lot of good science fiction written that has character-based scenes in it. I do like the term magic realism. Although I don't tend to use terms a whole lot when I'm thinking about my work, publishers and bookstores tend to slap those terms on things. And I have written works that have appeared in science fiction magazines and in horror magazines and in fantasy magazines and in mainstream magazines. And I'm just always really looking for the good story and the interesting people. The thing I liked about Veins when I was working on it is that the landscape becomes a character. And this landscape that we have in western Pennsylvania is so rich and it's so ripe for fiction. And writers who have discovered it have unearthed a great treasure trove of imagery. We live in an area where the world closes in on us. I've been doing a lot of traveling with this book, and when I'm out west and I'm coming home through Ohio, and I notice these vast open spaces, and then gradually the world begins to close in. And I find myself in this part of the country, my home, where horizons are close, and horizons sometimes are high above us. And the valleys are full of shadows, and we never know what's around the next bend. And sometimes you're driving along, and there's a sheared-off wall alongside you, and there in the sheared-off walls, the entire history of the earth in veins and strata of rock. And I just think that this is so rich and ripe for a storyteller that what I was really looking for in Veins was some interesting characters interacting with the interesting character of the landscape.
I guess I would ask, kind of going back to the fantasy angle or the approach to it, is there are plenty of writers who have, you know, approached ideas of landscape, both maybe, you know, in your studying, as you said, there are some great writers from this area. I think about writers who have really dealt with landscape as character in, you know, pretty much every territory in the world, and for sure in the United States. So I'm wondering, as you're developing these characters, there's the choice to keep them of this world and then a choice to kind of broaden your view of who that could be. And how do you make that choice?
I think in a way, every character in this story is of the world that she or he is in and is also of another world. And sometimes those other worlds are fantasy worlds. But a lot of times in this novel, they're just other worlds. Let's take the great-grandmother character, for example. Late in life, she finds that she's wondering about where she came from, and she begins to have these dreams that maybe they're prophetic. Maybe she's just remembering. Maybe she's just reminiscing. And she recalls a language that she heard when she was a child, a language that was spoken in western Pennsylvania that's not spoken anymore. And she begins to use this language, bits and pieces of it that she remembers from her childhood, to explain this kind of cosmic consciousness which is coming into her. And so she is of a different world, although she never really becomes a fantastic character. We have a character like Spinelli who comes north to Pittsburgh from North Carolina. And he is trying to get away from a past, from a life that is different from the life he would like to be living. And all through the book, we have characters from other places. And then into the midst of this, we have a fantastic creature that is introduced in the beginning of the book called Quetis. And he is first seen in the great-grandmother's dream. And the great-grandmother passes her awareness of him onto Axel in the stories that she tells him. And then as Axel comes toward adulthood, he begins to think about these stories, and they begin to become very real for him. And Just how real, how close that Quetis creature gets to him, I better hold back on that.
That's an
important revelation that happens in the story.
Absolutely. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Lawrence C. Connelly, reading from his novel, Veins. Lawrence, would you read some more?
Yes, I would. We have the two characters, great-grandmother and Axel, go down into the mine. Now, this is a surface mine. This is not closed. This is an open pit, huge open pit in the middle of the forest, and it's partially overgrown. It's been abandoned. And when he's down there with her, something uncanny happens, and it's actually something that takes him 9 years to really begin to sort out and get in touch with. And at one point, he can't take it anymore, and he runs away. He leaves her in the mine and tries to get back home on his own. And as he does, strange things begin to cross his path, and this is that scene. The moon hung low, shining across the mine, casting Axel's shadow against the high wall as he climbed the screw thread road. Exposed coal veins lined the rock, blending with the darkness of his passing shadow. He touched them as he ran, feeling the chill of their slow time, eras folding back on themselves, the past bearing down upon the past, compressing, transforming. The path steepened as he neared a column of protruding rock. He stopped running, taking his time, trying not to look at the drop that loomed a few feet to his left. His moon-tossed shadow moved with him, shifting away from the wall, falling against the path as he rounded the column. Then he stopped. He had company. A man stood before him, coughing as if struggling to clear his lungs. He had braided hair and tattooed arms, like the men in pictures Yayastani had shared when talking about the old ways. But this man had nothing to do with old ways. And Axel, wanting nothing to do with him, stepped aside as the man pushed forward, onto the screw thread road, and down toward the ledge of machined rock. Axel turned and ran. Trees rose, jagged against the sky. He hurried toward them, stumbling into the trail. His sides ached, but still he ran, hurtling onward until darkness forced him to cut his speed to a cautious jog. The trail veered, following the inward curve of the wall, bringing him back to the place where an hour ago he had looked up at the overhanging roots and branches of a massive ledge-clinging tree. But now the tree straddled the path, branches tangled in undergrowth, roots broken against the alcove wall. He ducked beneath it, emerging to find someone racing toward him from farther up the trail. She wore clothes that merged with the darkness, but one of her eyes glowed milky green against the shadows of her face. She ducked as she reached the fallen tree, and before he could step aside, she vanished in a gust of wind that had nothing to do with moving air. But the sound of her running lingered, as if she had passed through him and was now continuing on toward the crater. How much more of this could he stand before he lost his mind? Or had he already lost it? He pushed onward, coming to a piece of sheet metal lying partially embedded in the rutted ground. It was the OSM sign, smeared with mud and trailing a piece of chain. Further on, he found more chain, a longer piece twisted like a metal snake in a pool of moonlight. The links looked wet. Gasoline, he thought, realizing he had been smelling the fumes for some time. The air reeked of it. And 50 feet later, when he came to the posts at the edge of the clearing, he saw why. A wide spill covered the ground. He avoided it, cutting through a line of brambles and into the glade that seemed different from the one he had passed through an hour earlier. Was it the same space? The trees looked taller, as if they had cycled through a decade of summers during the time he had spent in the mine. And beneath those trees sat a junked car with a smashed grill and a rust-spattered trunk. But the rust wasn't rust, and the car wasn't empty. A piece of a man sat inside. Axel turned and ran, moving faster as he neared the portion of trail that led to Cliff Mine Run. Leaves hissed behind him, clattering in the still air as if something large were moving through the trees, but he didn't look back. He had seen enough. He wanted to be out of the forest, back home, safe in a place where things made sense. But even as he moved forward, he heard the rumble of another surprise waiting beyond the clearing. It sounded like an engine, and there was light out there, too, muted and diffused, like the glow of headlights through trailside ferns. He slowed his pace and slipped behind a patch of yarrow grass, inching forward, peering between the leaves. He saw a heavy-set man in a suit standing 50 feet away, back lit by glowing foliage. The glow seemed to come from a car that had gone over the slope. And there was something else, a detail that Axel couldn't quite discern in the uneven light. It resembled a gigantic snake, long and black, stretching across the trail and coiling about the base of a leaning cedar. Maybe it was a downed cable, a low-lying vine, an illusion. But whatever it was, the man ignored it and studied the clearing. "Hey," the man said, "is somebody there?" Axel held his ground, refusing to move, becoming one with the blades of yarrow grass until the man backed away, turned, and ran through the glowing ferns that lined the trail. And as the ferns swayed with the man's passing, Axel once again heard the rustle of something moving at his back, the sound of something entering the clearing, coming toward him. Axel ran, his body becoming like the wind, as he hurtled out of the clearing and down the trail, away from the thrashing hiss that stirred the forest. Like the man on the trail, Axel ran without looking back.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Lawrence C. Connelly, reading from his novel Veins. Lawrence, I want to talk a little bit about the structure of the novel. You have very short chapters, and they, in essence, there's a long extended action in the novel that's about a heist, and we get both sides from the people who have taken something and the people who have had something taken from them. And the chapters tend to be sometimes 3, sometimes 5 pages long, and they kind of stop action, and then we go to the whoever is the other side at that moment, and we kind of get what's going on with them, and then we come back. I was just curious about the choice to do that as opposed to kind of leaving us with the characters a little bit longer.
Yes, exactly. This is what I'm going for here. Think of the novel as strata. We have layers and layers upon layers. And veins, actually veins, the term veins is used to refer to veins of coal, which are really strata of coal. But the term veins also refers to rock that cross-cuts the strata, cuts through the veins. And so in this book, what we're doing is we're cutting through. We're following a vein through the strata of these characters' stories. And at the beginning of the passage that I just read, with Axel noticing the coal veins and noticing how the strata double back and they buckle and they fold in on each other and they begin to compress and they change and they morph into something else, this is kind of the structure that I was thinking of when I was working on the book. It's a nice way, from a technical aspect, from a writer's aspect, it's a nice way to keep the action moving while exploring multiple points of view. I'm a great fan of genre, and what I'm doing in this book, in addition to cutting back and forth between characters, is in a way we're cutting back and forth between genres too. We have kind of the hard-boiled. We have the heist, which is an important element of the story. We also have the metaphysical philosophy of Yayastani, especially as she nears the end of her life. And we have some outright, frightening dark fantasy scenes when, Spinelli, one of the characters, is lost in the forest and there's definitely something in front of him and he can't quite see it, but it's getting closer and closer. So, yes, I'm glad you picked up on that, because that was what I thought as I was writing the book. This is an important element of the way this story needs to be told. Sometimes chapters out of sequence, sometimes chapters spanning sequence where one chapter will end, and then after a series of other vignettes and adventures we have maybe 5-6 chapters later, we return right to that moment, right where it left off. And sometimes we actually step back and we run the scene again from a different point of view. So this was all what I was looking to explore within the book.
Did you have to storyboard it for yourself?
I did do some storyboards along the way, but the book really evolved organically as I was working on it. And I've been working on it for a while. It actually started the story actually started to percolate maybe about 8 years ago. I was working on a story for the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. And I was thinking at the time that it would be nice to do Veins as the follow-up, and I would make it a novelette. It would be about 40, 50 manuscript pages long. But when I got to the book, it started to really grow and grow. And so I put it aside and came back to it and put it aside. And it began to take shape. And so I had the luxury of having a lot of time to think about it. I also had an extremely strong editor at Fantasist Enterprises. And this is just a terrific publisher that has been around for about 8 years, specializing in fantasy literature. And Will Horner really helped shape this. And he actually, right before I wanted to say the book was finished, but he said, no, let's move this chapter. He actually wanted to move a couple of chapters around. And so the final form is partly, working with a good editor, too.
It's always true, isn't it? A good writer needs a good editor.
Absolutely.
Well, Lawrence, believe it or not, our time is up. So thank you so much for coming to Prosody.
Terrific. Great to be here.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Ben Cole. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP.